to the Disciple Makers Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Stovall. Thanks so much for listening in today. This is the fourth installment of the series we've been working through about disciple-making movements, or as I like to call them, DMMs. This episode is hosted by Ken Shackelford. If this is your first time listening to a podcast of ours, I encourage you to go back to at least episode 24 of this season to listen to the intro to disciple-making movements before going any further on this series. Ken is interviewing Roy Moran, who he introduces at the very top of the episode, and this show aired inside Classroom 3 of our Discipleship.org collective. And if you haven't already, please go check out what that is, because you may be asking, inside a classroom, what's that about? Go to discipleship.org/collective and sign up for a free account and find out for yourself. All right, guys, let's dive into this conversation.
Hey, welcome everyone. I'm glad to have you here for what is the fourth in a series of seven discussions we are having that are focused on this topic. What can the church, specifically the North American church, learn from these amazing disciple-making movements that are happening around the world? And though this interview today with Roy Moran is pre-recorded, I and others are here live with you. So for those of you watching this live, feel free to have a conversation in the collective chat room during this. If you have questions, we'll be happy to engage with you in that. And I'd like for you to contemplate this question as you listen to this interview. What does it mean to value obedience over just knowledge? So without further delay, let's jump into this interview.
Hey, I'm thrilled today to have my friend Roy Moran with me, and he, as you can see, he's got some Baylor connections, so he's still celebrating. Which I, as a Arkansas Razorbacks fan, you know, I'll have to just grin and endure it. They beat us in the Sweet 16 this year, but we played them good, so that's good. But it's great to have Roy. Roy's lead pastor of Shoal Creek Community Church in North Kansas City area, or as he calls himself, Chief Scout and Trailblazer, is that?
Yeah.
Trailbuster, like that. That's what it is. Yeah. So, anyway, he's also the author of this book, Spent Matches, Igniting Signal Fires for the Spiritually Dissatisfied, which I would highly recommend for anyone. I think any of you that are already watching this podcast are already interested in the things that he is dealing with in this, and kind of thinking about disciple-making movements happening here in our culture. It really deals with that well. You also have a leadership role with the organization New Generations.
Yeah.
And New Generations probably connected to more disciple-making movements around the world than just about any other organization I know of. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Yeah.
What's your role with them?
Well, I'm a chairman of the board, but I also serve on the operational side and handling the North American region.
Okay.
A couple of years ago, the international guys really felt like there were so many people coming at them from North America. We needed someone in North America to be a traffic cop for that kind
right.
of stuff.
So, because it is definitely all over the place, but there's so much interest in all of that here too.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And God seems to have you connected with a lot of great things. I know you have a connection with the Beyond organization as well.
Sure.
I mentioned that because I just finished interviewing Justin Long for this series,
and good friend. Yeah,
he's a good guy to get with when you want to dig into what a disciple making movement is and the numbers and all of that. So I was privileged just to have a little bit of time with you when we lived in the Kansas City area after we returned from Albania. And kind of going through all that reentry stuff, but we were blessed to work with the U.S. Base for All Nations, and at that time also just living in that area, it was neat to see in lots of different streams people who were really getting serious about making disciples. So Roy, you and I and others got together and kicked off something called Disciple KC, just trying to network the like-minded people together. Yeah. And that was a lot of fun. And what's happening in the Kansas City area with those kinds of things?
Well, it's still going, man. You kind of teased us here. You came in and then got involved and then all of a sudden you were gone and it's like, oh no. So I'm just privileged to be back here and connecting with you. Again, always enjoyed the time together, but Disciple KC is still blowing and going. We have a number of different partners. Since you were here, something's called KC Underground has started, sort of a collection of micro churches that are committed to a DMM strategy in the city. So that's been collecting a whole lot of people who really want to pursue the idea of the gospel happening at the disciple making level, not at the evangelism level. So they're doing really well and they've become a part of it. Corey Osmond and Corey, he and I spent a lot of time together and Corey has become a part of that leadership team with Rob Wagner and Brian Johnson and a couple other folks, so they're doing really good with that. We meet on Monday mornings to pray together for the city. We meet on Tuesday mornings. We've got a separate group that's just focused on the nations in Kansas City.
So, which there are a lot of.
Yeah. So we've got a group of folks that are building a rhythm for planting the gospel in a disciple-making way amongst the nations in Kansas City. It's continued to really bubble over and spread around.
Yeah. So exciting to me. And I have this feeling that these types of things are happening in a lot of the big cities around this country. And that's really exciting. And so before we dive into the subject of this webinar series, which is for those of you maybe that have just popped on and haven't heard the ones leading up to this, we're basically trying to learn from the disciple-making movements that are happening around the world, and they are amazing. If you don't know about them, please dive in and check them out. There's lots of resources on discipleship.org as well as other places. Read something like Miraculous Movements or a book like that to kind of get your feet wet. But historically, we've looked at the U.S. as being something where we're going and kind of blessing the world. But now the world can bless us because there are some movements happening. We have a lot to learn from that. Before we get into that with Roy, though, Roy, tell us your story. How did someone make the journey all the way from Dallas Theological Seminary to Willow Creek style seeker-oriented Sunday services to talking about disciple-making movements and using phrases like spiritual terrorists and that kind of thing? So how did that journey happen?
Well, it really starts out of a heart for the Father's heart, in a sense that what does God want most? He wants a family, and that family, deserted him in the garden, and he tried to build it again through Israel, and that didn't work out too well. And so when Jesus came, to really sort of cement things, that heart has always been in me to seek the lost and to be able to help God partner with him in finding his not yet brothers and sisters, or my not yet brothers and sisters, and put them, bring them into the family. So
it's amazing. It's amazing how that heart can send you on a journey that you don't expect.
Exactly. Yeah. Love does amazing things. So that whole journey is really pieced together by that scarlet thread. And we found ourselves at Shoal Creek, as you mentioned, doing a Willow style service on Sundays, no musical worship on Sundays. We didn't collect people from other churches that were mad or angry because they didn't play the right mix of musical worship that they liked. They just didn't find any at Shoal Creek and they moved on. So we grew on the basis of lost people. And as we found ourselves growing, God had blessed us with a piece of property and a building. And we discovered as we looked at our growth patterns that we were going to grow out of that pretty quickly. And we didn't think our style of ministry would really fit capital campaigns that have to raise money and build buildings and all that kind of stuff. So we just said, we need to find a scalable model of ministry. And so we just started looking, you know, what could allow us to stay in this building and make it a training center, you know, not a place that collects people and allow us to continue to fulfill the Great Commission.
And when you say scalable, you're talking about not just having a movable wall or something. You're talking about how can we have 200, 300,000 people being reached in this area?
And this is where the story gets really weird, in the sense that we were praying for 300,000 people. We put a pin in the map, drew 30 minutes around and said, there's 300,000 people in that circle. And let's pray that God would make it hard for them to go to hell because of us. And as we continued to figure that out and pray, you know, all of a sudden in the middle of this, now, you know, one key factor here that you mentioned early on, you know, how does a Dallas Seminary graduate get to blah, blah, blah? Well, in the middle of this, I had a dream. For those that understand the theological landscape, Dallas Seminary and dreams don't exactly belong in the same category. So that dream was a dream that all 300,000 people decided to come to Shoal Creek on a Sunday morning. And so the strategy that we were using to pursue the Great Commission was successful in getting them to start coming. But unfortunately, the strategy wasn't successful in its completion because all 300,000 people couldn't get there on a Sunday morning.
I remember, I think you wrote about it in Spent Matches, or I've heard you talking about it, but how that dream was so sweet at the beginning because you saw people from so many different backgrounds, you know, shift workers getting off their night shift and, people of ill repute, you know, showing up and getting ready to go. And it was a sweet dream at the beginning, but it became a nightmare, right?
Yeah, it did, because the infrastructure that we have in our city doesn't support 300,000 people coming to the same place at one time, on a particular day. And so what started really sweet turned into tragedy because just the infrastructure wouldn't support them getting there. So they turn around and go home. So they start with, you know, a real impetus to connect with God, and the strategy itself got in the way. It didn't allow them, you know, to really complete that. And that was why the dream turned to a nightmare. And it was that dream that God was using along with reading the book by Spontaneous Expansion of a Church and Its Hindrances. And as I was reading that book, you know, written in the 1900s, old book, he says something to the effect of, if your strategies and your dreams don't match up, it's probably your strategy that's a problem, because your dreams are probably more inclined to the heart of God. So it caused me to begin to say, okay, if we are going to pray this prayer and mean it, then we're going to have to find a different way to go about the Great Commission. And so that just sent us on a trip, you know, first in the U.S., trying to talk to anybody that we could to find that scalable model of ministry that would allow us to see 300,000 people actually come to Jesus. As we went out, you know, we failed in the U.S. Just nobody in the U.S. had any kind of scalable model. So I just happened to cross an article by a friend. I didn't know him at that point. Now he's become a dear friend, Jim Egli, who was taking notes of a Victor John meeting in Nashville with a bunch of people who were interviewing him about what was going on amongst the Bhojpuri in northern India. And there were things in that just lit me on fire, caused me to start to find all the people I could connected with this. I ran into a David Watson through a guy named David Broderick, and began to just have my life turned upside down as they began to expose me to some principles that would disciple people to conversion rather than evangelize them to conversion. And that was right. just bizarre, because I've been through all, I'm qualified in all the typical evangelism training things that you could do out there, and this idea of disciple someone, to conversion was really bizarre. But they,
how would you, in a short paragraph, how would you just delineate between those two things, disciple someone to conversion as opposed to evangelize them?
Well, I grew up in a Christianity that said that the front porch or the front door was basically accepting Jesus, is like these facts about the cross. That was the entryway into the life. And unfortunately, not only was the entryway, but it usually was the ending way as well. It just get to the cross and that's it.
Right.
I got my ticket to heaven and that kind of stuff. And so it was about persuasion. It was about helping people understand that God loves you, you're a sinner, that Christ died for you, and you need to receive him and to become his child. Nothing wrong with that. And I'm not, I wouldn't deny any of those things as being absolutely fundamentally eternally true. But on the other side, I began to realize I began to be coached in helping people understand what would it look like to start reading the Bible as the primary start. And so I read the Bible and respond to it in obedience and respond to it by saying, okay, if this is God speaking, what am I going to do about it? And then encouraging them then to share that with the people that they live, learn, work, and play with. And so that simple process of hearing, obeying, and sharing became a brand new strategy. We call it a discovery group now. We have seven questions that we invite people to the table and say, hey, let's just begin to explore who God is. And so through a series of small decisions to obey God, people move into the family.
A relational journey together, right? Yeah. Well, so we're definitely going to dive in deeper with that. But getting back to your story, so you were hearing stuff about the Bhojpuri and Northern India. You were getting messed up by David Watson, things like that. Where did that take you?
Well, we as a staff, we began to ask ourselves. First, I had a period of crazy where I think I'm crazy, and this is like really backing the truck up on my entire education. As you can
it's
see,
I call it a stripping away. I just felt for a long time God was just stripping baggage off of me, and it was baggage I was wanting to hold on to. I mean, I felt comfortable with that stuff, right?
Exactly. I mean, it was me, unfortunately, and it felt like ripping skin off
our identity.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good thing. I know that there are church leaders, pastors, preachers, ministers watching this and feeling uncomfortable with some of the ideas they're hearing, maybe even wary or fearful or I don't know, but that's it's not an easy process. But would you agree, as far as once you get through that, there was a lot of burden that God took off of me in that process?
Yeah, in several different ways. I think of it like my father was in the Air Force, so I have a real affection for aviation stuff. And watching the sound barrier be broken, in an airplane, there's this moment as you're approaching that 600-mile an hour deal the shaking that takes place in the aircraft, and it feels like it, especially before they learn to get the airframe, really tuned. Those early attempts, it shook really violently, and several people lost their lives. More than several, a bunch of people lost their lives trying to do that. It feels like that moment, where you're trying to go through the sound barrier, you're shaking violently, and then on the other side, there's a slipstream, and it's just like, and it gets really quiet and calm. And that's what it was for me. And there are numerous ways of looking at it. I'm sitting here in a 115-year-old house that has been completely remodeled, and, you know, tearing down the old stuff, like, you know, there was no wiring in the walls. It was all knob and tube. And so we had to strip down and rewire and stuff. And so, you know, there is a deconstruction phase that's very healthy, you know, and you've got to get to some sound footing before you can reconstruct and get it back up. And so that's what happened to me in that process, is I began to reread the Bible, you know, with really different eyes, and understand that some of the methodologies that I had accepted as biblical, and those methodologies worked. I mean, they saw people come to faith, but they weren't necessarily founded in the Bible. You know, they weren't commanded by Jesus. And so giving them up was not a matter of giving up orthodoxy. And so I had to really, what a lot of people do is our orthopraxy and our orthodoxy are sort of twisted together.
And
we don't realize that our methodologies, you know, aren't necessarily our theology.
Right.
And so
we often put those methods up on pedestals where only Jesus belongs. Right. Mm-hmm. And we don't realize how much we worship them.
Yep, exactly. So that took a while for us, you know, for me to be able to do that. But, you know, it allowed us to come through a phase where we looked at what we were doing, and, you know, we were focused on reaching lost people, and we were seeing people, you know, connect with their father and enter the family. So what we were doing, we didn't look at as bad. We just looked at it and said, look, if we were going to pray for 300,000 people and we were going to really believe that God could use us to bring them to faith, then this is not the only strategy that we need. This will do a little bit, but it will not complete the task. And so that allowed us to kind of move into a hybrid strategy that I developed, you know, to look at this ministry where we kept the, you know, the attractional, the collectional thing, because, mm-hmm. you know, on a regular basis, even now and during COVID, we still have plenty of non-believing families who attend, and it's a great access to, quote, persons of peace, as we, you know, we're able to rethink ourselves and understand that term on the other side. It's great access ministry, but if the gospel doesn't move away from us, if we can't plant it where people live, learn, work, and play, and really encourage it to move away from us rather than just solely focus on it moving toward us, then we'll never reach those 300,000.
So you see, and a lot of the conversation that's coming up is, do you have to, or some of the questions is, when they start experiencing, I guess, the simplicity of disciple-making movements, do you have to completely blow up every church structure? Do you have to get rid of everything before you can do this? Is there a both and? What I'm hearing you say is you see what you were doing before as a great, almost funneling tool to train and funnel people into becoming disciple makers, becoming disciples first and becoming mm-hmm. disciple makers almost at the same time, right?
Yeah, I think there's a, I wouldn't say there's a synthesis, but there is a tension that can be held, that the analogy of the hybrid car works for me in the sense is that it has an electric engine and it has a gas engine in it. The two are radically different technologies, and it takes different tools and different methodologies to be able to work on them. But within that car, because the mission of the automobile is just transportation, the two very different strategies work together for the same goal. So if you can get, you know, the right mission in place, you know, then right. then that hybrid strategy can work for you, because both of them are attempting, you know, to fulfill the Great Commission.
And we have the right mission given to us, but I think there, and I know you agree with this, there's some eye opening that needs to be done, which you said God pretty much gave you a dream to start that process, that what we have been doing is not going to have the transformative impact on our communities, on our families, on the lost that our mission has basically prompted us to be about, right?
So there's some
eye-opening that needs to happen.
You know, identifying in Spent Match is about 10 different mindset shifts that have to take place, right off the bat, for those of us who lead local churches and get evaluated by, leadership teams and that kind of stuff. It comes to grips with the fact that whether we really admit it or not, the idea of more butts in the seats is one of the major pieces in which we get evaluated, is getting more people there. And when this mindset shift, comes, you come to realize that I've got to really release people and be comfortable with having some of my most effective people amongst the lost not attending the major services on Sunday morning.
Yeah, and our models are typically, we want to hang on to the best and brightest.
Yep.
And we want to keep them close to us. And that idea of taking our best and brightest, taking our Pauls and Barnabases and saying, hey, let's get you guys out of here to do greater things is runs against the grain.
Yeah. Most in the Western world, we've made quite a few mistakes in terms of bringing what's been brought from the East to the West, in a sense, and not really thinking through well, because this is about culture issues. And it's not just about training individuals to do things differently. These local fellowships that we have are really, they have a particular culture to them. And I see a lot of the problems that happen with people bringing disciple-making movement strategy to a Western church is that they're trying to impose something that comes out of a radically different culture. And I'm not talking about foreign culture that's Kenyan or sub-Saharan African. Right. I'm talking about a different theological culture, a different way of doing things. Cultures, is basically a language and customs, or language and repeated habits and stuff. Right. And so the habits of a movement are different from the habits of a local church. And so we're in effect changing the center of gravity of a person's spirituality from being, Sunday to Sunday to being, every day of the week where they live, learn, work, and play. And ecclesia is not what I come to. Ecclesia is what I do. And so forming ecclesia, in my workplace or in my neighborhood or those kind of things is really a foreign concept to people.
Right.
It's hard for people to get their hands around.
Well, one of the, in the blog article I wrote to introduce this webinar series, I talked about different areas that are barriers to disciple making movements happening specifically within our Western culture, but even more specifically within our Western evangelical church culture. And one of those, I know you're pretty passionate about, it's in your book, you address it, but that idea of valuing obedience over just knowledge. And I put the just in there because it's not that we're not valuing knowledge, but we're not valuing it alone. We see the importance of obedience, and those mind shifts that you talk about, that going from knowledge to obedience is a big cultural shift, right?
Yeah, definitely. We both grown up in a church and that used the terms discipleship, as a euphemism for the collection of knowledge. And the more knowledge you collect, supposedly, the more spiritual you would become. And so that metaphor or that track that we're on, we both know, and we've looked around at many, many people in life, you know, you can have some really knowledgeable people about the things of the Bible, and sometimes they're the meanest people in the room. They do not, you know, exhibit the spirit of Jesus. And so, you know, the idea here, you know, is simply saying that knowledge is a means and not an end. And we've kind of mistaken knowledge as the end rather than the means. And so we do need facts about the Bible, Jesus. We need to understand these tidbits of truth, in a sense. But the end is doing what Jesus says, not knowing what Jesus says.
Yeah. And so, American culture isn't unique to this. I mean, you shared how you shared in your book how this started early on, and that shift from the Hebrew culture, the following your rabbi, to the Greek culture.
Yeah.
This shift is not new and coming. It's been around a while.
No. And we, you know, as the gospel moved from Jerusalem to Athens, you know, we see that in that article I mentioned, you know, the great, your big fat Greek mind,
yeah.
Go out and Google that. There's a part one's really the more interesting one of it. But that, you know, we did see the idea of, as the Greeks began to become the pervasive way of thinking in the world, you know, the separation of the material and the immaterial, and the idea right. that the soul or those spiritual parts and the physical parts were disconnected, whereas in the Hebrew world that Jesus gives us these truths in, it's a unified world. And the yeah. idea, you know, of knowing something and not doing it just didn't fit in a Hebrew mind. And that's why Jesus says, if you love me, do what I say. You know, I mean, it's clear, obedience is clear, but yet we have such a warped view of this something we call grace, and we're so fearful of legalism, and because we're so immature in our understanding there, we can't see the allegiance factor, you know, in the gospel as not yeah. being works. And we've got some great guys, you know, that have been exploring that, Scott McKnight, Matthew Bates, and you know, Tom Wright, all those guys have been helping us understand that there is an allegiance factor in this, you know, gospel that
absolutely.
Jesus,
and
changing, you know, me being king to Jesus being king.
Right. Yeah. And I, one of the quotes I wrote down in my notes was, the God of the Bible is meant to be related to and obeyed. I think if you're a knowledge-based teacher, you can do that just fine without getting into the messiness of relationships, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But if you're really focusing on obedience and walking this out together, you can't really do that without the obviously being relational with God, but really relational with others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, I think that the profound narrative that controls things is what drives us, you know, our metaphors, basically, you know, the meta narrative, that story mm-hmm. that's in our head. Mm-hmm. So the simplest way I think to think about it is like, take the word conflict. If we are in a room full of people, 20 people, and we do a little survey, we've got some electronic devices and we say words and we have them hit positive or negative. And so we say conflict, you know, my guess is that, you know, at least half, if not three quarters, if not all of the people are going to hit negative when they hear the word conflict. Right. And then if you back the truck up a little bit and you ask yourself, okay, what are these word pictures? What are these images that are behind the word conflict? And most of them, when you think about it, relate to warlike type stuff. All you know, if you and I are in conflict, what's in our minds are these, you know, stand your ground, you know, stay
battles. Okay,
yeah, the battles and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so those pictures, those word pictures, really do affect our emotional state in terms of how we react to things. And you know, I think of the meta narrative of understanding that. Take for instance. If you're looking at a systematic theology and you're looking at, okay, and you're in the attributes of God area and you're asking, okay, what's the core attribute of God? You know, what is the central core attribute? And the reality is that, you know, probably two of the most pervasive theological systems that exists, you know, in the U.S. or in the world, you know, one would say glory. mm-hmm. is, and one would say love. And I would suggest that they're both wrong. And I would suggest that, and this attribute usually doesn't even appear in most traditional lists, but I would suggest that the core attribute is generosity. Mm. That the Father, Son, and Spirit, they were givers. That they were giving to one another in their relationship, and because of this motivation to be generous, they created a family that they could invite into this life that they had, this ultimate reality of the Trinitarian God. They wanted people to experience that.
That's great. So generosity seeks to share.
Yeah, right? yeah. And so they gave us this. You know, they built a family, and of course, you know, the story is the family deserted, and then human history is spent with this triune God seeking to create this family. And now once you become a part of the family, you get the grand privilege of continuing the process of building that family, of going out and experiencing the DNA of your Father, and his Son and Spirit, you know, to give away what you've been given.
Which unfortunately is not the experience of so many of those butts in the seat, as you said. You know, they have not. Now they'll experience some relationship if it's a healthy church. You know, they're going to be doing some community. They're going to have small groups, or so they're experiencing that. But the amazing joy of seeing that experience grow with others who have not yet experienced it is not in the typical framework of the life of a pew warmer, right?
No. I think what we've done is we've exchanged growth, or we've exchanged multiplication, or it's just another way of saying generosity, for growth. And so the pseudo life of the average Christian, which is the normal life of the average Christian, is to grow, is to get you know, more and more and more, more mature. And it's disconnected, you know, from their Father's heart. And as a result, that's why I would call it pseudo. It's like they're collecting facts, they're collecting knowledge, understanding.
They're intaking. I like the phrase spiritually obese, you know, they're getting filled. They're like the people on Mars Hill. They're looking for those new ideas that even based in truth, you know, I'm not talking about going off into heresies, but even based in truth, they want to find new ways of thinking about those things and just get filled and filled and filled, but they're not putting it into practice. Right. But this culture shift of not just doing knowledge, and instead very intentionally seeking ways to put it into practice, you know, like the wise man who built his house on a rock, right? Listening to the words of Jesus, putting it into practice. That's a pretty powerful paradigm shift for the Western church.
I want to take a quick break and tell you about something cool happening over at discipleship.org. It's our discipleship.org collective. It's an online community for disciples and disciple makers. And if you fit in either one of those categories, then the collective is designed just for you. The website itself is super cool because it's basically like stepping into a virtual church building with a welcome center, an auditorium for our main events, and even classrooms. Right now, you can get free access to this collective with all of its webinars, seminars, ebooks, and even disciple-making assessments for you personally or for your whole church. And this is a community, so you can also have the opportunity to connect with other disciple-makers. And while membership is free, there's also a premium access option, which includes courses, certifications, and online gatherings with other leaders from around the world. So head on over to discipleship.org/collective and sign up for your free membership today.
One of the things you say in your book is another, I guess, mind shift. You say from knowledge to obedience, but you also say from analysis to synthesis. What does that mean?
Well, I think we spend a lot of time in the details, and those details are not necessarily obeyable in a sense. You know, for instance, you and I could get into a discussion about the Ordo Salutis, and we could argue about whether we're lapsarian or infralapsarian or superlapsarians and that kind of stuff. And theologians and, you know, systematic theologies have that kind of stuff in them. But, and we think that we've reached the pinnacle of our spirituality when we can throw those terms around. But the fact is that it doesn't mean anything, you know. What means something is that when I walk out of my house, on Wednesday morning, and I look across the street and I see that my neighbor set his trash can out, and overnight that trash can spilled into the street. And what am I going to do about it? You know, am I just going to think, my dumb neighbor who set their trash can on an uneven deal serves him right, he should have to come out here and clean it up? Or am I going to love my neighbor because it's,
are you going to be generous?
Yeah. Am I going to go over there and do what I really don't think I need to do? In a sense, my flesh says, you know, just go about your day. You know, you're already just on time, and this will make you late. Or am I going to do what Jesus said? I'm going to love my neighbor, you know? And that's just a small way of, you know, that kind of thinking has come to understand that my relationship with God, you know, should drive me, but when his heart captures my heart, to generosity in my world and giving away the life that he's given me.
Yeah. And it's instead of just understanding, there's meaning there, it's purposeful, right? Mm-hmm. And, I think there's two areas I'd like for us, before this ends, to jump into. One might be a little bit of a rabbit trail. One is often spoken over disciple making movements, the idea that it's a mile wide and you know, a foot deep or an inch deep. In other words, because they see this obedience focus, they're thinking, well, they're not really getting the theological depth that they need. What do you say to those types of things?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first question I would ask someone is that how do they know this? You know, right. Because if they've never traveled and been in the midst of a place where the gospel is moving, my guess, they've never experienced what I've experienced, and that is a depth amongst people who come to faith as obedient followers of Jesus, rather than come to faith accepting Jesus as their savior.
Right.
The difference is radical, and so the question, or the characterization of a 60 miles wide and 16th of an inch deep, is just totally false.
Right. Talk about that for a moment. When did you first experience hands-on being a disciple-making movement, and what impact did that have on you?
Well, you know, where I spent the most time is in Eastern Africa, and sitting amongst especially some of the tribal peoples there, and beginning to watch what happens when the gospel takes root in this culture that prior to this was so demeaning to females. The use of a female as an object was just a natural part of their culture. Mm-hmm. And watching the gospel embed itself in this culture, and watching men raise their awareness of these females in their family and in their tribes who were image bearers. They were made in the image of God, and begin, you know, to stop physically abusing them or sexually abusing them, to begin to treat them as truly, you know, image bearers.
They weren't doing that because someone told them stop doing it. They were doing it because Christ was growing in their heart, right?
Yeah. I mean, when they began to, you know, they began to see that they were made in the image of God, you know, male and female, you know, he made them. And so that all of a sudden just realized, oh my, the ground at the foot of the cross is level. And we have a culture that is unlevel. And because we're pledging allegiance to this new king, we need to reorient the world that we're living in. It's not missionaries come in and tell them to stop being their wives, that kind of stuff, but it's, you know, this idea of the Bible, you know, being lived out in their lives. So, you know, 16 miles wide and a 16th inch deep usually comes because of the use of the term rapid, the rapid expansion of the gospel. And when, you know, David Garrison and other leaders, you know, have talked about this as a rapid movement. You know, people presume that anything that's rapid can't be have it's, depth it's, to it.
Right, right.
And I would say that that's true if you're in a knowledge-based paradigm.
Yeah.
It takes time. It takes time to acquire all of those facts, and those facts then over time accumulate. But unfortunately, I think, you know, something is true about that. That is true. You know, the Lifeway Ligonier study that shows in evangelical churches that American evangelicalism is 16 miles wide and 16th of an inch deep.
Yeah, right, right.
The average person sitting in a church today, you know, believes one of, you know, at least one out of every two people believe one of the traditional 10 heresies that exists in the church.
That makes me think of one of the things I think all of us know is that when we see someone go on a mission trip and they very intentionally, what, you know, they typically, you know, go to a different culture, they experience a lot of different things, but they're also go purposefully. So they're doing something that's gospel oriented, typically, even if it's just serving. Mm-hmm. And they always come back talking about that 1 week or those 10 days, they grew more in those 10 days than in the past few years or something. And why is that? Well, they were putting their faith into practice very intentionally. And so in these movements, that is normal Christianity, right?
Yeah.
And so you see that depth drive down deep in a very fast way, mm-hmm. Because they're taking what they're learning, and they won't know lapsarianism or anything yeah. like that.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
what they will know is that Jesus wants them to find a way to show love to their enemy. And mm-hmm. the person that's really bugging them right now. And so they will go out and actually do that. Mm-hmm. And God, the Spirit, one of the things you say is that there's a partnership with the Spirit, right? Mm-hmm. And I like to talk about, to do this, you really have to trust the Spirit mm-hmm. and trust mm-hmm. the Spirit can work in people, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we have such an inordinate confidence in our own ability to communicate ideas, and we think that that's going to shape people when, in fact, that confidence is just ill-placed. This is a spiritual warfare, and it is the Spirit of God that is enlivening, you know, someone and empowering them to really become an obedient disciple of Jesus. And so, yeah, it's... you know, you'll find in this whole world, as you know, Ken, people like myself who come out of a Dallas Seminary type of deal where the Spirit was known and discussed and talked about, but not necessarily in our experience, we would have not had a Trinitarian God necessarily, you know, it's God the Father, God the Son, and the Spirit. You know, and it's raising up this idea, and it you know, it's just this idea that there is a genuine spiritual trust that comes as the Spirit of God, you know, moves in the lives of another person, and you can see it. You know, it's like when you set a table, you know, and I think of a discovery group and that whole analogy that Jesus told Peter. He says, feed my sheep, feed my sheep, feed my sheep, which people usually tend to abuse that to mm-hmm. think that that's what happens on Sunday mornings, that a so-called professional gets up and feeds a sheep. But you know, what you really do is have an obese Christian, you know, you know, sharing with people while they, you know, lightly listen to them. Mm-hmm. But this idea of setting a table, you know, for the sheep, letting them eat from the word, you know, and then go out and do what the word says, you know, is really the picture that Jesus has there. And that's the beauty of what happens in that. It's like you're talking about, you know, you and I both know that you learn something when you try to teach it to someone else. You really do learn it, you know. So that's why, like Stephen Covey, for instance, at the very end of his book, you know, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, says, go teach this to someone, you know, this week. You know, and that's probably why that book became so pervasive, is that he pushed people, you know, to do that. And Jesus did the same.
But we think, but we think of that teaching as always a top down intellectual transfer thing. You like to use the term learning designer instead of teacher. What does that mean?
Well, you know, the pictures, the word pictures behind our words, you know, really are controlling. And in the Western world, because, you know, we're content based, we're sort of subject matter expert based, teaching, the presumption is a transfer of knowledge. So I have a set of facts that I'm going to give to you. And then in our whole educational system is based on, you know, me designing a test for you to give those facts back to me that you, tells me you know them. It doesn't tell me you can do them or anything. It just tells me you know them and stuff. But
or it tells the teacher, or in my experience, I was extremely good at knowing them just long enough to take that test and then doing a complete dump thereafter, right?
Yeah. It's like you tell people on your way to the test, don't touch me, I might leak, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, the word teacher, especially when you find it in the Hebrew, you know, is the idea of cause to learn. And if we think about that, some of our greatest teachers that we've ever had are the people who cause us to learn, not that delivered facts to us. And you know, I think about some of the great, you know, men in my life and women who have taught me, they were question askers, not so much content dumpers. They caused me to learn. They caused me to do things with the knowledge.
They probably caused you to ask questions too, maybe even drive that, the direction of that learning by your questions, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
I know in my experience in disciple making movements, that's where so much of the learning happens, because they're going out and doing obedience and they're having these experiences, good and bad. And, you know, they're running up against walls at times. Sometimes they're experiencing some victories, but then they'll come back from that full of questions and will kind of drive that learning that will point them to certain scriptures for those answers.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, there's the idea of, the Gadarene demoniac, you know, where Jesus heals this man and he wants to get in the boat with Jesus and go across. And Jesus says, no, go back to where you came from and tell him what's done to you. You know, I mean, that's the picture we're talking about,
right?
Is there's been a powerful, transformation of a life only, you know, attributable to the Spirit of God and it, you know, healing this man and sending him back. And instead of, you know, taking him through the, you know, the five fundamentals of the faith, or, you know, the whatever, you know, paradigm you want to use, you know, Jesus sends him back to simply share his experience with people. You follow that trail back to Decapolis where we think he came from, you know, and you see that there were some amazing things that happened there as a result of this guy.
And the, you know, for someone so overcome by evil, so set free, you would think, oh, he's going to be really wounded. We need to shelter him in place for a while. We need to keep the big bad world away from him, right? But Jesus obviously had a trust in the transforming work to really make him one of the first commissioned missionaries to go out. And I think it worked. You know, later in the gospel, you see them going back and there's crowds waiting. You know, we don't know that that's from him, but it certainly could have been. But yeah, that's that trust is so powerful. If you follow Jesus' model, you know, you look at him sending out the 12 in Luke 9 and the 70 in Luke 10, and first, you know, laying on them pretty impossible expectations, some things they can only do through the power of God, right? But then you look, read the rest of the chapter 9 in between those two, and you see just how messed up they were in their thinking. And but he really trusts in them, and he trusts in us, and he wants you to trust Jesus with others, I think.
Oh yeah. I mean, you see that at the Great Commission, you know, and I always memorized, you know, growing up Matthew 28, 19 and 20. But if you go back to 16, where it says, you know, they showed up where Jesus told them to. So we got obedience going here, but right. We have obedience in two different crowds. One, it says some worship when Jesus showed up and some doubted when Jesus showed mm-hmm. up. And right. So we didn't really, you know, crank the time chain back and say, okay, we, you know, doubters, you know, worshipers, keep going here, you know, sing 17 more verses of some song while I sit over here and help these doubters get their act together.
Right. Yeah.
He doesn't even pause. He just delivers the Great Commission to both worshipers and doubters at the same time. So, yeah, there's a different way of looking at things than I grew up with. You know, there was a sense of I wanted, you know, one of those mindset shifts was to trust the qualified. So I had to figure out where do they get qualified, and then I can release them once they're qualified. And you know, Jesus just released the willing.
Yeah, and that's the willing to obey, right?
Exactly.
The willing to obey.
Yeah.
Well, one other thing, and this was the rabbit trail I was talking about, but that in your book, it really got me thinking because I'm very passionate about unity in the body of Christ and the power of that. You know, when Jesus prayed for his followers to be one in John 17, it was, you see this reason for that prayer, and that's so that the world will know, right? And that's our heart. When we connect with Jesus' heart, we want the world to know him. Mm-hmm. And so God's done a lot of work in my life to build that passion for unity. You gave me kind of a different way of seeing how unity in Christ is possible through obedience, because in the Greek culture, they're always seeking that unifying principle, which is elusive and can never seem to be grasped. Mm-hmm. But in Hebrew culture, things could be held in tension as you go out working together in obedience, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
That was really powerful to me. Explain that a little bit.
Well, I think it's a difference between, you know, unity and uniformity, you know, in a sense is that we tend to think of unity as, we all think the same. We act the same. We believe the same. You know, we have absolutely no sense of disagreement. Or it's like the word consensus. You know, you try to get people in a consensus, and you can get 8 people on a board to vote the same way, and you call that consensus. But I guarantee you that every one of them probably has about 20% doubt on what they just voted in. You know, and stuff. So we're in a sense being inauthentic to one another in that sense. So it's about, you know, it's really not about uniformity. You know, unity is found in diversity in that sense, is that, you know, Jesus is the one who gives us, you know, apostles, prophets, evangelists, you know, shepherds, teachers. Is the idea of the whole mixture of gifts and stuff. God created male and female. You know, there's all this diversity that exists, you know, in a sense. And so learning to appreciate that diversity and understanding that, you know, we both have allegiance to a king, but we might think different about the way you baptize.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's, I'm fine with that. You know, you baptize the way you want to baptize. I'll baptize the way I want to baptize.
We're going to baptize because that's obedience to a clear command, but it may look different or you might think about it differently. Right.
Yeah. I have to hold my understanding of baptism loosely simply because Jesus didn't say baptize this way.
Right.
You know, he said, look, identify, you know, that's the word baptism, you know, identify them. How do you publicly identify someone, you know, with a new king in their life? That's what we're talking about. Right. You know, you define it one way, I'll define another, but that's okay. You know, that
we don't one of the same. One of the things that I get so excited about when I have seen and experienced these disciple making movements is that they're not holding any banners that that divide them from anyone else following Jesus. You just see them following Jesus. You know, there's it just seems that putting it into practice seems to draw us around the King, right?
Yeah.
And the small stuff, the little academic fine points that often drive division kind of fall by the wayside. It's not that those become unimportant, but there's something more important, and that's to walk with the King.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a sense in which, you know, we come to realize that you and I are practicing an unbranded type of Christianity. We have grown up in a branded type of Christianity, you know, whether it's the, you know, the restoration movement or dispensationalism or, you know, a covenant theology or, you know, a liturgical world of, you know, Presbyterians or Methodists or, you know, that whole branded world is one thing. But in these movements, what you see is kind of an unbranded style of Christianity that says, look, we're going to take these human imposed filters, these theological frameworks, and we're going to keep them away from this, and we're going to allow this gospel to move unfettered, lightweight, you know, low maintenance type thing,
to
move unfettered, because, you know, it's unbranded. We're not trying to impose these human developed type systems on people.
And I think that's one of the reasons that we're seeing God's anointing on it, because I think he's looking for people who put one brand up, that's Jesus. and that's where he wants to pour his blessings out on. Mm-hmm. So, well, Roy, we're about out of time. I would love to go much longer with you, because I so enjoy just hearing your take on things, and I appreciate you spending time with us in this. And I want to point folks to some of the resources I know that you're connected with that are available. First of all, you've got a website after your name, right,
Roy? Yeah, roymoran.com.
RoyMoran.com. I'm sure you've got resources in there, probably some blog articles, things like that.
Yep, there's lots of stuff there. Another place, DisciplemakingMovements.com, is just a general site. If you want to connect with New Generations, you can go to newgenerations.us or .ca if you're in Canada. That's our
North American I also want to recommend the podcast that's available at that website called Movement Conversations, and really, really love the conversations you're having with lots of great people. Anything else on that list of resources?
That's it. That'll get them enough.
Yes, absolutely. There's and there are so many great resources. Obviously, discipleship.org is continually pointing people towards avenues to get some good training and to get serious and intentional about developing a disciple making culture within their church, if they're church leaders, or just within their life, if they're not. And that's really where it happens.
Exactly.
Great. Well, that's awesome. Thank you so much, Roy. And I just really appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Well, man, I just appreciate you know, the whole discipleship.org family and the stuff, you know, that I've been involved with Bobby and stuff. It's just been it's really good stuff. So keep it up.
Yeah. All right. Well, blessings.
Well, it was indeed a blessing to spend some time with my friend Roy, and I pray that you were blessed as well. And if you've not had the chance to watch or listen to the earlier episodes of this series, you can go to the collective within discipleship.org, and all the interviews in this series are in classroom number 3. And of course, you can check the other classrooms for other great content. Next week, I'm blessed to have Curtis Sargent with me. He was a part of disciple-making movements in Asia and is connected to training up disciple-making leaders in countries all around the world. And I mean all around the world, including here in North America. And we're going to be discussing, talking about real, relevant, transformative communities. Disciple-making movements are all about relationships and loving, grace-filled accountability. And getting this right is very countercultural, including our Western church culture, but it is crucial for multiplying movements to happen. So thank you for being with us, and I hope you will join us next week. God bless you.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode. I hope that y'all enjoyed it. And I want to remind you, November 4th and 5th of 2021, we're hosting another National Disciple Making Forum here in Nashville, Tennessee. So mark your calendars and go to discipleship.org and purchase your tickets today. All right. Have a great day. I'll see y'all in the next episode.